But as we continue our overview of the Bible this year, journeying through God's Word in a relatively chronological order, hopefully at this point you have finished your daily Bible reading for the month of May, which has brought you up through 1 Kings chapter 11. And so today we are, in fact, going to wrap up our discussion of the United Kingdom time period by looking primarily at the reign of Solomon. And even though there is much less information, I found that the chronology of this section is actually much simpler, especially when compared to that of Saul and David's reign. Irregardless, I'm still going to take the same approach with this lesson that I've done with the last two. I'm going to lay out some of the key dates first, not boring you with how I've arrived at my chronology, and then we'll go back and fill in some of the blanks. But as we've done with all of the lessons in this series, let's begin with the 3,000-foot overview. Again, the text that we're covering in our discussion today is 1 Kings chapter 2 through 11 and their parallels in 2 Chronicles chapter 1 through 9. We also looked at Psalm 72, the first 24 Proverbs, the book of Song of Solomon, and the book of Ecclesiastes in our reading this last month. And so, even though we're talking about the United Kingdom, a period of 120 years, that covers the reigns of Saul, David, and Solomon, each 40 years apiece, we are today only going to be looking at from 970 to 930 BC, the 40-year reign of King Solomon. So just some bullet points overview of this section of biblical history. Upon the death of his father David, Solomon inherits a relatively well-established and peaceful empire. Because of this inherited peace, after some minor consolidation of his power, Solomon is going to be able to focus on the economic prosperity of the nation and also the religious interests of the Israelites. And he's going to follow through on the construction of the temple, a project for which his predecessor David had made ample preparations. He's going to also build for himself a palace, a rather luxurious palace in Jerusalem, and several other impressive buildings as part of his royal complex. In his early years, we're going to see that he earnestly sought the counsel of God and God's guidance, even boldly encouraging his subjects to be faithful to their covenant relationship to God, giving him the honor that is due him. But Solomon will not always remain true in his own heart. Later on in his life, we'll see that his allegiance is going to become divided between a devotion to God on the one hand and a love for his many wives on the other. And for this division in his heart, God is going to execute the judgment that he had beforehand promised to Solomon's father David when he told David that he would have a son. You'll remember in 2 Samuel chapter 7 and in verse 14, God said about the son, "I will be a father to him and he will be a son to me. And when he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and with the strokes of the sons of men." And we'll see that God will send some adversaries in to punish Solomon for his lack of total devotion to God in his later years. And ultimately, we're going to see that due to Solomon's failure to keep his covenant with God, the division or the seeds of division will be sown, and ultimately it's going to lead to a harvest of captivity and a temporary ejection of Israel from the promised land. The thread that we're following through this section of our study is the same that we've looked at in the last two lessons. This is not new, but we've seen through the time period of the United Kingdom the establishment of the Davidic dynasty and God's promises regarding the coming of the son of David, who will sit on the throne of David forever, building a lasting temple. And as we look today at Solomon, we're going to see clearly that Solomon is not the final fulfillment of that promise, because Solomon is indeed not going to sit on the throne of David forever. And ultimately, we'll see that the temple that he builds is not going to stand forever. And so we look beyond Solomon for the fulfillment of these promises, the ultimate fulfillment. We look to the future to see the building of a lasting temple, a temple that, by the way, we ourselves are a part of today as living stones. And we're looking to one who will reign over an eternal kingdom. And so clearly that was not something that God intended to be achieved on the purely physical level, but ultimately on the spiritual level. And we'll see that fulfilled ultimately in Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So as we dig a little bit deeper into this section of history, I'll again begin by laying out some key dates and chronological markers. This will be a review a little bit from David's timeline last week. There's just a couple things I want to remind us of on David's timeline that pertain particularly to Solomon. It was during the last 33 years of David's reign, where he reigned from the city of Jerusalem, that maybe around 990 BC, he had this idea that I'm going to build a temple for God. God said, you're not going to be the one who builds it for me because you're a man of bloodshed and warfare, but I will give you a son after you who will build a temple for me. And that son was ultimately promised to be Solomon, who was maybe born around 988, 987 BC. As we'll see, he is still a very young man at the end of David's reign when he is anointed king to sit on the throne in the place of his father David. And so that brings us forward then to the reign of Solomon, 970 to 930 BC. And I think we can best break this up into four major parts. Really, one precedes the beginning of his actual reign. There was a slight co-regency between Solomon and his father David for a year or a few years at the very end of David's reign. And then we've got about 4 years that I'll call the early reign of Solomon, where he's consolidating his power. And then he'll spend a 20-year period pursuing all sorts of building projects. And we'll talk about those in due course of time. And then the sad years of his life, the latter years, when his heart will unfortunately turn away from God. And we see the beginning of his decline, both spiritually and then ultimately physically as a nation of Israel. So let's go back now and fill in some of the blanks and give a little bit more depth to this time period in the reign of Solomon. And as I said, we have to begin really before his reign began with his co-regency with his father David, because we need to look at a couple items here that we referenced briefly last week in order to understand some of the actions that we see Solomon take in the early years of his sole reign. In David's old age, his health was failing, and his fourth eldest son, by the name of Adonijah, probably the oldest living son of David, sees the weakness of his father and makes a bid for the crown. He is supported by Joab, the often self-willed and sometimes underhanded commander of David's army, and Abiathar, the priest, who had been with David since the days that David was fleeing through the Philistine wilderness as a fugitive running from Saul. And they take Adonijah to a place just outside the city of Jerusalem named Enrogel, and there they offer sacrifices and proclaim him as the next king of Israel. Well, Nathan, the prophet, Zadok, the priest, another priest, Benaiah, one of David's mighty men who will ultimately become the commander of Solomon's army, and several others assist Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, in informing David about this plot of Adonijah. And together, they remind David of the promise of God regarding Solomon, that he would be the one who would sit on the throne after him and build the temple, and David's own promises to Bathsheba that he would make that so. And so David commands that Solomon at this point be publicly declared the next king, and that he would reign alongside David for his remaining years. And so they, that is Nathan and Zadok and Benaiah and Bathsheba, many of David's mighty men and a lot of other people who were influential in the kingdom of David, they take Solomon to Gihon, which is only about half a mile away from Enrogel, where Adonijah is having his great celebration of being proclaimed the next king. And there they anoint Solomon king and loudly proclaim this fact with shouts accompanied by musical instruments. Now, when the sound of Solomon's anointing reaches the ears of Adonijah, he immediately fears for his life. And so he runs to the altar there that's been erected outside the tent that David has set up to house the Ark of the Covenant temporarily in the city of Jerusalem. He grabs hold of the horns of the altar. There, almost, I get the idea, like from the Hunchback of Notre Dame screaming out, "Sanctuary, sanctuary." He's holding on to that altar because that's where he's hoping that if I just hold on to God here, Solomon will spare my life. Fortunately for him, Solomon does spare his life. And for the time being, Adonijah willfully submits to the choice of David, his father, and to the authority of Solomon, his younger brother, as the new king. In David's last days, he will give some final charges to his son Solomon. The first is regarding the construction of the temple, reminding Solomon that he was the son who was promised, who was supposed to accomplish this work. And David, in the presence of all, will remind Solomon and the people of all the preparations that he has made for this project. He's basically saying, here's all the material, son, you do the work. And he encourages Solomon to be bold in this, and he encourages the people to support Solomon in this endeavor. But he also encourages son Solomon to serve the Lord his God with a whole heart. Because he says, it's then and only then, son, that you will be truly successful in what you undertake. And then there is kind of this weird thing at the very end where David tells Solomon to take vengeance on a few people. And this seems almost a little bit out of character and out of place, but it is a part of the biblical record, and so it must have happened. I don't know exactly the motivation behind it, but apparently there was a purpose. Basically, David says to Solomon, I need you to take vengeance on Joab, the commander of my army, because during his life, he killed many people, not in times of warfare, but people who were innocent. We remember the story of him assassinating Abner, the king or the commander of Saul's army, who had defected to David. And we also see him killing Amasa, who was another guy that David was going to appoint to replace Joab. And it almost seems that Joab, in these two instances, was trying to eliminate his competition. And that did not sit very well with David, but that was something that he was not going to deal with. He asked his son Solomon to deal with that. And then there's also the case of the guy by the name of Shimei, who, if you remember, when David was fleeing Jerusalem under Absalom, his son's revolt, there was a guy who had come out and was hurling curses at David and saying some terrible things about him. And even though when David was restored, this Shimei repented, David tells his son Solomon, don't forget what he did to me, and I'm trusting that you'll take care of it in an appropriate way. And so there at the very end of David's life, Solomon is anointed a second time as king. And when David dies, he begins his sole reign as the king of Israel. And so as we look at the years of his early reign, these first 3 or 4 years, Solomon is going to spend the majority of his time consolidating his authority as king. Really, he's going to be eliminating opposition and threats to his position on the throne. The first comes in the form of getting rid of his older brother Adonijah. And Adonijah kind of gives him a good excuse because he comes to him and he says, can I marry Abishag, who was David's nurse in his old age? And I think that Solomon probably interpreted this request as an underhanded backdoor way of Adonijah trying to take the throne away from him. You see, there was a custom in the day that the incoming king would inherit the harem, all of the wives and concubines, of the preceding king. Now, Abishag was not technically a concubine nor a wife of King David, but I think Solomon saw this as Adonijah's way of trying to get in the back door. And so, as a result of this, Solomon has Adonijah executed. Immediately after that, Solomon banishes Abiathar the priest. He sends him home, says, you're no longer going to serve as priest before me. I'm going to have Zadok do that. And I think the reason he banishes Abiathar is because Abiathar, again, supported Adonijah and his efforts to take the throne back in the latter days of David's life. Now, when Joab finds out about the assassination or the execution of Adonijah and the banishment of Abiathar, he realizes, I'm in trouble. And so what does he do? He does just as Adonijah had done years before. He goes to the altar and grabs onto the horns of the altar, claiming sanctuary. And Solomon sends his new commander, Benaiah, and says, I don't care. Kill him even as he holds on to the altar. And that's maybe, to me, that's kind of an interesting story because it illustrates something. Sometimes we think as long as we hold on to the altar of God, we can do whatever we want to do and our lives will be spared. Let me tell you something. You live a life full of sin and rejection of God and selfishness,
you can come in this building every Sunday and you can hold on to the altar of God, it's not going to spare your life. That's not what saves you. It's the grace of God
that He freely gives to us when we humbly submit ourselves to Him. Not living self-willed lives the way Joab did. So Joab is eliminated. And then that Shimei, who really wasn't a threat to Solomon, but an old enemy of his father, he gives a condition. He says, listen, I'm not going to kill you, but you have to build a house in Jerusalem. You can never leave Jerusalem ever again. Shimei says, okay, that sounds pretty good to me. That's reasonable, Solomon. I'll take that deal. Well, about 3 years later, a couple of his slaves run away, and he goes and chases after them, knowing that if he leaves Jerusalem, he's forfeiting his own life. And so when Solomon finds out about it, he has him executed as well. During those early days, Solomon will also make a marriage alliance with Egypt. He'll marry the daughter of Pharaoh. And this, I would suggest to you, is one of the very early marriage alliances of Solomon. He's going to marry many women over the course of his life, but this seems to be one of the very early ones. Pharaoh's daughter was clearly very important to Solomon. He's going to ultimately build her own house in Jerusalem as part of his royal complex. We could read about that in 1 Kings chapter 7. But perhaps it was here, with the marriage and this alliance with Pharaoh and Egypt, that the seeds were sown, which would sprout into the beginning of Solomon's decline, and ultimately bear the fruit of a full-fledged idolatry that would incite the anger of the Lord against him. Go with me in the text real quick to 1 Kings chapter 11. This is fast-forwarding a little bit, but it gives a summary of some of what I'm talking about here. In verse 1 of 1 Kings chapter 11, it says, now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women. From the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, you shall not associate with them, nor shall they associate with you, for they will surely turn your hearts away from after their gods. Solomon held fast to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father had been. For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites. Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not follow the Lord fully as David his father had done. And Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable idol of Moab, on the mountain which is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the detestable idols of the sons of Ammon. Thus he did for all his foreign wives. He burnt incense and sacrifices to their gods. I find it interesting that Solomon here, maybe beginning with his marriage to Pharaoh's daughter, begins to go down a path that's going to just lead him further and further away from God. And when you think about it, it doesn't make any sense. He's marrying the princess of the land of their former oppression, Egypt. That was where they became a nation as slaves. And God had to miraculously and powerfully bring them out of there. And so what does Solomon do? He goes and makes an alliance with them. And then he proceeds to marry women from almost every nation, every tribe that God specifically said, don't intermingle with those people, annihilate them completely, because if you don't, there'll be a thorn in your side and they'll turn your hearts away from God. And yet Solomon marries one after the other, after the other, after the other, until he's accumulated 700 wives and 300 concubines. And we'll talk more about his ultimate demise later. But there's just at the beginning this inkling of him starting to head down a wrong path. But at his beginning, Solomon was actually pretty humble, and he sought after God. There was a time when he goes to the great high place at Gibeon where the tabernacle was still erected. Now, it didn't have the Ark of the Covenant there anymore because that was in Jerusalem, but there's where the altar was that the Israelites had carried around with them from the time of Mount Sinai. And there he goes and he's offering sacrifices to God, and God appears to Solomon in a dream at night and he says, ask what you wish me to give you. Solomon could have asked for anything. But Solomon, I think, very selflessly and humbly requests from God simply wisdom. God, I'm a young man. He describes himself as a baby, as a child. I don't know how to lead this people of yours in a way that's right and pleasing to you. Give me the wisdom to be able to do that. And God is very pleased with his request. And he grants him not only wisdom like nobody else before him, but also the promise of riches and honor and a long life. If, Solomon, you will remain faithful to me, if you will walk in my ways, I will prolong your life, the Lord tells him. And then there's that really cool test of his wisdom. You have the two harlots who come to Solomon there. And, you know, they both had just had a baby. And one of the babies is dead. The other baby's alive. And they're arguing over whose babies is whose, right? And Solomon can't figure out who's telling the truth. And so his solution is, bring me a sword. We're going to cut the baby in half and each of you can have a half. Well, pretty quick after that, the real mother becomes evident. Because she says, no, just let her have it. Let her have the baby. I just let the baby live. And the other one's saying, I don't care, I'll take half. Solomon knows who the real mother is. And from that point forward, his wisdom becomes something of renown and talked about and widespread. And that brings us then, though, to the years of building, the 20 years, the first seven of which were occupied by the construction of the temple. They commenced laying the foundation on the second day of the second month of the fourth year of Solomon's reign, so 966 BC. And it took 7 years to complete. It was completed on the eighth month of the 11th year, 959 BC. It was constructed on the site where David had offered sacrifice to check the plague that had resulted from the census, there at the threshing floor of Ornan or Araunah, the Jebusite. It's described here as the Mountain of Moriah, perhaps the same mountain where Abraham, nearly 1,100 years prior to this, was told to take Isaac, his son, and offer him as a sacrifice to God, Genesis chapter 22 and verse 2. It's also going to be very close to the place where 1,000 years after these events, Jesus Christ himself will be taken to a hill just outside the city and be sacrificed for our sins as an appeasing sacrifice to God. Once the temple is completed, the next year during the Feast of Booths, Solomon brings the Ark of the Covenant into the temple. And just as it had done when they erected the tabernacle before it and put the Ark of the Covenant in there, and the glory of the Lord came down and filled the tabernacle like a thick cloud so that the priests couldn't even minister, the same thing happens here in the temple, showing God's approval of this structure that Solomon has built. And Solomon gives a rather lengthy prayer of dedication and a sermon, really, to the people, impressing upon them the necessity of remaining true to God. Don't depart from him. Don't turn away from him. Always look to God. He is the source of everything for you. And there at the temple, they offered a great many sacrifices that day in celebration. Chronicles tells us 22,000 oxen and 120,000 sheep were offered that day. The next 13 years, Solomon spends building many other buildings in and around Jerusalem and throughout his empire. He begins construction on his own palace, something that occupied that entire 13 years. Also, he built what's called the Hall of Pillars, the Hall of the Throne, or the Judgment Seat. He also built the house for Pharaoh's daughter. In addition to that, he finished building the wall around Jerusalem, and he fortified the city by strengthening the Millo, which is thought to be maybe the fortress there in Jerusalem itself. And beyond this, he built many defensive cities and strategic storehouses throughout his empire, as well as constructing a fleet of ships that sailed from a port in Ezion Geber, which is at the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, the southern extremity of his empire, in order to conduct trade with the south and with the Orient. And it was at this time that God appears to Solomon a second time in a dream, towards the end of this 20 years of building, reminding him, Solomon, I told you before, you have to faithfully serve me with all your heart, and as long as you do, things will go well for you. But if you turn away from me, I will bring punishment against you. Sometime shortly after this, Solomon is visited by the Queen of Sheba. His wisdom, his riches, his wealth had gone now worldwide. His reputation preceded him. She had to come and check it out just for herself, and guess what? She was not disappointed. All of the reports about Solomon's majesty and his kingdom and his wisdom were true. Truly, there was no one like Solomon in his day. In regards to wisdom, riches, power, possession, Solomon had it all. He could do whatever he wanted to do. There was nothing that his eye desired that he had to deny himself. There was nothing outside the bounds of his ability to grasp, except maybe finding purpose in life. Because it's at this time that Solomon's heart really begins to turn away from God, as we read about there in 1 Kings 11, verses 1 through 8. And God warns him, Solomon, I told you that if you would faithfully serve me, I'd prolong your days. But if you reject me, I will reject you. Son, you have rejected me. And now I'm going to reject you. And so God raises up adversaries against them. You have Hadad, who is in Edom, a place that was previously conquered by his father David. Well, Hadad had fled to Egypt during the time that David was conquering Edom. Think, wait a minute, Solomon, aren't you pretty tight with the Egyptians? Don't you have that alliance with Pharaoh's daughter? And yet Egypt is sheltering your enemies? But it gets worse. He also has Rezin in Damascus in the north, who sends marauding bands in to torment them. And then even within Israel itself, God raises up Jeroboam, who was described as a valiant warrior, a great leader. In fact, Solomon had put Jeroboam at one point in charge of his forced labor. And yet God prophesied that it was going to be through Jeroboam that 10 of the tribes would be taken away from the household of David when Solomon's son Rehoboam ascended to the throne. And that there would be a rift, a division in the kingdom because of Solomon's heart wandering away from God towards other gods. Of course, Solomon takes a page out of his predecessor Saul's handbook. And when he finds out that Jeroboam is going to take the kingdom away from his son, what does he try to do? He tries to hunt Jeroboam down. Same way Saul tried to hunt David down when he found out David was going to take the kingdom from him. And where does Jeroboam go? I don't think it's a coincidence. He runs to Egypt and hides. Egypt is not a place that God's people need to tangle with. From their beginning as slaves there, until the days that we'll see when some of God's people try to flee to Egypt instead of being carried away into captivity. Egypt never works out for God's people. Egypt represents the world, guys. We try to make alliances with the world. We think we can be buddy-buddy with the world. We think that we can just kind of keep our connection there and everything will be okay. And all the while, the world is working behind our back to bring our demise. The same as Egypt was sheltering the enemies of God's kings. And so we would be wise to sever those ties completely. The last thing that we would mention about Solomon is his death. After reigning only 40 years. You remember God promised him, follow me and I will give you long life. Solomon was but a child, he describes himself, when he ascended to the throne. And he reigns for only 40 years. I would suggest to you that he died in his mid-50s, early 60s maybe. That's young compared to his father David, who attained the age of 70 when he died, which was even younger than Saul, who was probably in his 80s when he died. And I would suggest to you that indicates that Solomon did not remain true to God, and therefore God did not prolong his life. We have in 1 Kings chapter 4 a section that, by my estimation, is not chronological in order here. As far as this is not part of the chronological story, it's inserted here in 1 Kings chapter 4 to give us a summary, an overview of Solomon's reign throughout. And it's probably something that was compiled towards the end, if not after his life was actually over. And I just want to point out a couple things that it illustrates for us. It does illustrate that God fulfills his promises. It talks about how the nation of Israel and Judah, that the people were like the sands that are on the seashore in chapter 4 and verse 20. Well, that harkens back to God's promise to Abraham and his descendants that I will make your descendants as numerous as the sands of the sea, or the sands of the seashore. And of course, also outlined in that section is the extent of Solomon's kingdom, stretching from the brook of Egypt all the way to the great river Euphrates, which again, as we saw last week, Genesis chapter 15 and verse 18, is exactly the boundaries of the land that God promised Abraham he would give to his descendants after him. God keeps his promises, both the good and the bad. We're also told here about the wisdom of Solomon, 1,005 songs that he wrote, and 3,000 proverbs. Now, what we have preserved for us, for sure we know Psalm 72 was a psalm of Solomon in our book of Psalms. And also we have the book called The Song of Solomon, which really is a love poem, a love story between King Solomon and one of his early wives, the Shunammite, who was probably a Jewish bride from humbler circumstances that he had brought maybe from the regions of Galilee down into his palace and made his bride. It describes their initial meeting, their growing love and admiration for one another, their wedding, and their early marriage. 3,000 proverbs Solomon wrote. Proverbs chapter 1 through 24 are all attributed to Solomon. In fact, even 25 through 29 are attributed to Solomon. They were ones that were transposed or transcribed in the days of Hezekiah. That's why we haven't read them yet. But much of the book of Proverbs was written by Solomon. And in addition to that, we also have the book of Ecclesiastes, which I would suggest to you was written by Solomon in his old age, after he had tried everything to find purpose in life, only to realize that purpose is not found in money or possessions or pleasure or even his own wisdom that came from God, but rather purpose is found in seeking and serving God. Solomon is the smartest guy that ever lived, had more wisdom and knowledge and insight than anybody else, taught more people, arguably, than anybody else, maybe besides Jesus Christ. And yet, look at how terribly he failed at the end of his life. He could teach others, but he didn't listen to himself. It reminds me of Jesus' statement in Matthew chapter 7, verse 3. Why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye and you don't notice the log that's in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. How hard it is for us to see our own faults. Guys, it's not just enough to know God's word. You can quote it, you can cite it, you can know book, chapter, and verse for everything, but if you don't practice it, what is the point? Let us not be like Solomon, who could expound the wisdom of God for others to hear, but we didn't listen to ourselves. Let us put into practice that which we preach. Let us be people of the word, not just hearers, but as James says, those who are doers of the word, that we might be blessed. Now perhaps, even though we leave Solomon here at the end of his life with a glimmer of hope, perhaps before the silver cord was broken and the golden bowl was crushed, before the dust of his body returned to the earth and his spirit returned to the God who gave it, perhaps Solomon came to his senses. He repented of his idolatry and put God first in his life. Maybe that describes you today. All your life, you've been doing what you want to do. And you've come to your senses and realized this is not working. And I don't know how many days I have left, but every day that I have, I'm going to now devote it to serving my God. But realize this, that though Solomon might have been right with God at his end, the seeds were already sown for the decline of the coming generations who would follow him. And I would suggest to you that's a warning for us as well. We can put off serving God and submitting our lives to him. We say, I got a lot of fun that I need to do. I got a lot of experiences in life that I want to have. And when I'm filled with pleasure and possessions and what I want to do, then I'll repent and turn my life over to God. Well, that may work. And God, I believe, is gracious and he will still save you. But think about how many seeds you will have sown that may not affect your salvation, but the salvation of those who will come after you. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. That's what Solomon said. So I would suggest to you, whether you are young or old, if you are not submitting to the Lord, today is the day to begin.